Senator Senjum.
Madam President, I move that further proceedings under the roll call be dispensed with and the Sergeant of Arms be instructed to bring in the absent members.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Today's chaplain is Reverend Kevin McDonough from St. Peter Claver Church in St. Paul. And following the prayer, please remain standing for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Good morning, Madam President. Members, this is the first time I've been back with you since the death of your senatorial colleague and my ministerial colleague, Senator Kubley. I'm remembering him this morning, but in a particular way, I'd like to remember his people and all of ours who, after a dry winter and a warm spring, are a little worried about the fields. Let's pray for a good harvest this year. Let's pray. Sufficient rain, we ask. Good sun, rich soil, safety, and good prices for farmers, enough food for the poor. All these blessings we ask in your holy name. Amen.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice.
Secretary will take the roll.
Senators Bach, Benson, Bonhoff, Brown, Carlson, Chamberlain, Cohen, Dames, Daly, DeKreif, Dibble, Dietzick, Eaton, Fischbach, Gazelka, Gerlach, Gimsey, Goodwin, Hall, Han, Harrington, Hayden, Higgins, Hoffman, Howe, Ingebrigtsen, Jungbauer, Kielash, Koch, Cruz, Langseth, Latz, Lilly, Limmer, Lori, Magnus, Marty, McGuire, Metzen, Michelle, Miller, Nelson, Newman, Nino, Olson, Ortman, Pappas, Perry, Peterson, Reinert, Rest, Roebling, Rosen, Saxog, Senjum, Sharon, Sieben, Skoy, Sparks, Tump, Thompson, Tomasoni, Torres, Ray, Vandeveer, Uyghur, Wolf.
A quorum is present. Moving on today's Senate agenda to the second order of business, there are executive and official communications printed on page one. Please make note of those. Moving to the third order of business, messages from the House Secretary Secretary Ludeman will read the first message.
Madam President, I have the honor to announce the passage by the House of the following Senate file. Herewith return Senate file 1542, a bill for an act relating to insurance. Albany Mathewitz, Chief Clerk, House of Representatives.
There's no Senate action necessary on that message. Secretary Ludeman will read the next message.
Madam President, I have the honor to announce that the House has acceded to the request of the Senate for the appointment of a conference committee consisting of 5 members of the House on the amendments adopted by the House of the following House file. House file number 1567, a bill for an act relating to environment. There has been appointed as such committee on the part of the House Fabian, Hancock, McNamara, Torkelson, and Dill. Senate file number 1567 is herewith returned to the Senate. Albany Mathewitz, Chief Clerk, House of Representatives.
There is no Senate action necessary on that message. We will be skipping the next message. The Secretary will read the message at the top of page 3.
Madam President, I have the honor to announce the passage by the House of the following House files herewith transmitted. House file number 2173, 2253, 2793, and 1923. Albany Mathewitz, Chief Clerk, House of Representatives.
There's no Senate action necessary on that message. Moving to the fourth order of business, the first reading of House bills. They are printed on page 3 of today's Senate agenda. They will be referred as indicated. First reading. Moving to the eighth order of business, introduction and first reading of bills. They are printed on today's Senate bill introduction. They will be referred as indicated. First reading. Moving to the ninth order of business, motions and resolutions. There are 4 motions printed at the bottom of page 3. They will be taken as one motion. All in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. There is one Senate Resolution 142, printed on page 4 of today's Senate agenda. It will be referred to rules. Remaining under motions and resolutions, Senator Perry.
Madam President, I move that the appointments withdrawn from the Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans and placed on the confirmation calendar under Senate Rule 8.2, reported in the Journal for May 22, 2011, be returned to the committee from which they were withdrawn. The what we're doing is looking to go through confirmations for the Board of Arts, Pamela Perry Weaver, the Gambling Control Board, Gino Frignito, Susan McCarville, and Gary Sigfrinius, and the Minnesota Racing Commission, Mark A. Arista.
Senator Latz.
Madam President, would the Senator Perry please explain what the purpose is of this, since, as I understand the process, these matters were already considered by committee and were sent to the Senate floor. Why are they going back to committee? Or maybe I need some information
Senator Perry.
About the process.
Thank you, Madam President and Senator Latz. They were pulled to Rules Committee from the Senate floor, and so we're just pulling it back so that we can tomorrow in our committee go through them and then bring them through the confirmation process.
To Senator Perry's motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Remaining under motions and resolutions, Senator Senjum.
Madam President, pursuant to Rule 26, I would like to designate the following bills to be made special orders for immediate consideration. And Madam Chair, may I just, rather than read them all, refer to the list and make a motion in block?
Senator Senjum, you don't have to make a motion. It's just a designation, so designate those that were handed out, and that will be, I believe everybody received one on their desk, and if they did not, they're available here at the front of the chamber. So Senator Senjum has designated the list that was distributed as special orders, and we will begin with number 112 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 2342, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, Senate File 2342 deals with no-fault auto insurance reform. Last session, we had three significant reform bills to our auto insurance no-fault system. They were discussed but not passed. While none of the bills passed into law, as a result of our action and the debate at the legislature last session, a process was commenced during the interim that brought together the auto insurers and the chiropractors to discuss possible reforms to the medical coverage portion of our law, plus other issues that both groups have with the current system. While the process of continuing Senate File 2342 is a product of those discussions, this is a very targeted reform bill that strengthens current law, which deals with unethical practices of a small number of providers. The bill strengthens current law to deal with deceptive advertising by some health care providers when soliciting individuals who have been injured in auto accidents. Minnesotans who are injured in auto accidents may receive solicitations by certain providers today that are either confusing or very unclear as to who is soliciting them for medical care. Senate File 2342 is supported by the spokesman for the insurance and chiropractic industries, and assuming this bill may go to conference committee, you have my commitment that I will not move forward with a final product unless the advocates of both the insurance and chiropractic industries support the final product. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Further discussion on Senate File 2342. Secretary will give Senate File 2342 its third reading.
Senate File Number 2342, a bill for an act relating to commerce, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 2342. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 63 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Continuing on the special orders calendar, it's number 22 on the general orders calendar, House File 2455, Senator DeCraeff.
Thank you, Madam President. House File 2455 is a bill that's related to local government land conveyance to veteran service organizations. This bill would allow a town, city, county, or other public corporation to lease or convey land for less than market value to a congressionally chartered veteran service organization for public use. And these include organizations like the VFWs, the American Legions, or AMVETS. The conveyance would be conditioned upon the service group's agreement to notify the local government if the group wishes to convey the property. The group would also have to agree to convey the property back to the local government upon request. We have had good cooperation working through the committees, and I don't know of any opposition to this.
Further discussion on House File 2455. Secretary will give Senate or House File 2455 its third reading.
House File number 2455, a bill for an act relating to the city of Montgomery, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on House File 2455. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 63 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Continuing on, special orders number 86 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 1993, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, today we have Senate File 1993 before you, which is a bill relating to the modification of license exemptions relating specifically to certain types of sump pumps. We have, I want to take a moment just to thank the other authors on this bill, Senator DeCraeff and Senator Metzen as well. What this bill does is simply change a definition of the word plumbing so that we have a certain group of basement health contractors that can install sump pumps into residential homes. It'd be residential construction only, creating a situation that's much better for the consumer.
Further discussion on Senate File 1993. Secretary will give Senate File 1993 its third reading.
Senate File number 1993, a bill for an act relating to building codes, third reading.
Secretary to take the roll on Senate File 1993. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 65 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Remaining on special orders, number 102 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 2184, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Madam President, this and members, this might be considered the omnibus timeshare interest title and registration bill. Certainly a lot of interest in this one. Whenever timeshares are sold, there's not only at least on a foreclosure process, one has to go through the foreclosure proceedings, and then as a second step, unique to a Torrens property, timeshare property, they must go through a second step called a proceeding subsequent to get good title back in the association's name. This bill would eliminate the second judicial step of the proceeding subsequent by allowing the county examiner of titles to determine the legal sufficiency of the foreclosure rather than a second court process in addition to the foreclosure itself. The bill only applies to timeshare property interests of up to 1 week in ownership, and only if the county, upon recommendation by the county recorder, has formally opted to authorize the county examiner of titles to cancel qualifying timeshare interests within the second step. This is clearly permissive language if the county decides to go forward. Timeshare associations want to get these units back on the market. This would save not only money, and it would save time. Whenever an association is in a foreclosure or unit in foreclosure, those association dues are not being paid in, and that puts the whole property itself in jeopardy. And this bill establishes an alternative foreclosure method that significantly reduces the cost in very limited circumstances. The Minnesota Bar Association assisted in writing the language in this bill, and I will stand for questions if there are any.
Further discussion on Senate File 2184. Secretary will give Senate File 2184 its third reading.
Senate File Number 2184, a bill for an act relating to real property, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 2184. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 65 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Next on special orders is number 90 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 1860, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam President and members. This Senate File 1860 relates to concrete slurry deposit in regards to specific road projects, and I have an amendment, the A4 amendment.
Senator Peterson offers the A4 amendment. The secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Peterson moves to amend Senate File Number 1860 as follows, page 1 after line 20. Insert, this is the A4 amendment.
To the amendment, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam President. This amendment is a simple language change. It just changes the effective date simply the day following the final enactment. This amendment is in an effort to try and capture cost savings on road repair projects that we'd have right away this season, this building season, this spring and summer.
Discussion to the A4 amendment. Senator Dibble. To the A4? No.
Yeah, Madam President, my computer is taking a moment to pull it up here. If we can just pause
for one second,
I can look at it. Thank you.
We'll wait a minute. Senator Dibble.
Thank you. That's fine, Madam President.
Seeing no further discussion on the A4 amendment, Senator Peterson renews his motion that Senate File 1860 be amended. All in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. To Senate File 1860, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam President. This bill, members, some of you may have heard it in committee, it relates specifically to how we do road repair here in Minnesota and really around the country. This bill relates specifically to contractors that you see maybe have been grinding down interstate highways, getting them in a much more drivable condition and safe road conditions. Currently, what is required of these diamond grinding contractors is to vacuum up the slurry that's created, which is simply just water and the material that's ground off the surface of the road. That's required to be vacuumed up and currently hauled to a landfill. However, you'll see a message here specifically from both from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Minnesota Department of Transportation talking about their agreement on this bill. It simply is changing the definition and exempting concrete slurry from the definition of solid waste. So in short, this material now can be just deposited in the grassy bank alongside the roadway, saving the taxpayers in Minnesota a significant amount of road repair dollars. It will save road repair dollars and tax dollars right away this season once this bill is enacted. We'd be grateful for your support, along with Senators Gimsey, DeCryf, and Gazelka. We're all co-sponsors on this bill as well.
Further discussion, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam President. I do have a question, as it turns out. And I want to thank Senator Peterson. I know that what seemed to be a simple proposition became slightly more complicated, and I appreciate his time and work on this. And I appreciate the language that talks about best practices so we don't do something that we didn't intend to do, which is impact soil quality and water quality and the like. My question actually is about the amendment, Madam President, if Senator Peterson would yield.
Senator Peterson will yield. Senator Dibble.
Senator Peterson, if your bill speaks to a manner that is in compliance with best management practices and rules of the agency, we just adopted the amendment on the effective date, the day following final enactment, which may be in a few days. Does this give us enough time? I mean, I understand we're trying to allow this to occur for yet this construction season with the nice weather that's upon us. But I'm just concerned: are we ready to go with these best management practices and these rules of the agency? Or is more time needed for the agency and the industry to establish these best management practices?
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam President. And Senator Dibble, it's my understanding is that we did come to an agreement on these best practices before the state agencies were willing to sign off on it. So we should have those agreements in place.
Senator Dibble.
So thank you, Madam President. So to be clear, the agencies are comfortable with the effective date being the day following final enactment, the PCA and MnDOT.
Senator Peterson.
Yes, as far as I'm aware of at this point, Madam President.
Further discussion, Senate File 1860. Secretary will give Senate File 1860's third reading.
Senate File Number 1860, a bill for an act relating to environment, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 1860. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 65 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Moving on to number 126 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 1815, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam President and members. Before us today, I have Senate File 1815, has to do with the right of first refusal. Senate File 1815 aims to preserve the current system for how utility transmission lines are built in Minnesota. Since 2005, when the CapEx 2020 legislation was passed with bipartisan support, the state's utilities, working cooperatively under a system that allows the right of first refusal, have combined to invest billions of dollars in needed infrastructure to support our statewide electric grid. This bill gives greater certainty and thereby allows this investment to continue. Members, I see this as a state's rights versus federal rights. If we choose to do nothing, we are giving control over to the federal government to decide how our transmission lines in Minnesota are handled and who builds them, where they go. I want to keep how we've been operating in Minnesota consistent with where we've been up to this point. So a yes vote on this bill will accomplish that. There are there was a little bit of opposition in committee, and those were two transmission line builders from outside of the state of Minnesota who wanted to be able to have the first right. Members, I would ask for your support on this bill, and I also want to thank my co-authors, Senators Sparks, Benson, and Rosen, for their help with this. Thank you.
Further discussion on Senate File 1815, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam President. I stand in strong support and want to thank Senator Brown for his work on this. This was a very big priority for the utilities. You know, Minnesota is a regulated market, and injecting competition into this regulated system may have unintended consequences. So we don't even know what this new competitive transmission line process will look like that FERC is developing. So we would like to just keep status quo. It's been working. The utilities need certainty going forward. So I stand strong support that we keep it in the state level. And once the feds have a process in place, then we can take another look at it.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam President. I also wanted to express my support for this bill. I agree with the points made previously, and I can't remember if Senator Brown pointed out or not, but in case he didn't, we do need to act on this this session. If we fail to act, the FERC order eliminates our right to act and take this step on our own behalf and manage this process within the state in July of this year. We could always go back if the FERC process turns out to be a good one and desirable for our transmission program, transmission services, our utilities, and our ratepayers. But we don't know that right now because the process established hasn't even been established. We don't know exactly what is going to unfold in terms of routing, siting, who pays, how much they pay, etc. So it's very important that we take this step so that we retain that prerogative with the PUC in the state of Minnesota with our utilities. For the time being, this question of competition is a wide open question that still has yet to be answered. Thank you, Madam President.
Further discussion on Senate File 1815. Secretary will give Senate File 1815 its third reading.
Senate File Number 1815, a bill for an act relating to energy, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 1815. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 65 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Going to number 54 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 2334, Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Madam President. Senate File 2334 provides more transparency in public utilities reporting of lobbying expenses that impact the cost to the public. It does so by separating out spending to influence administrative actions from overall lobbying expenses. And I would like to thank the co-authors on the bill, Senator Sieben, Harrington, and Chamberlain. I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Further discussion on Senate File 2334, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam President. Madam President, I'd like to offer the A2 amendment.
Senator Dibble offers the A2 amendment. The Secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Dibble moves to amend Senate File 2334 as follows, page 1 after line 4, insert. This is the A2 amendment.
To the amendment, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, the A2 amendment is also a sunshine disclosure effort. It corresponds to my Senate File 2249. And what it does very simply is it defines, adds to the definition of the term lobbyist, to those who attempt to influence legislative adoption of model legislation. That's distributed by a principal, and then it goes on to define what model legislation is. It adds to the definition of principal those who draft, promote, or distribute model legislation to any public official with the purpose of influencing that person to introduce legislation or vote in favor of that legislation. Then it adds the notion of scholarship funds, meaning those funds that are used to bring public officials or to reimburse them to conferences or meetings or events where this model legislation is presented and discussed, et cetera. And then it ensures that if any of us are to receive these scholarship funds for those purposes, that we make that disclosure on our statement of economic interest. Madam President and members, I myself have been the guest of an organization that works on environmental policy. I've received reimbursement for my travel. I've received legislative proposals, some of which I've pursued. It would mean that organization would have to be identified either as a lobbyist or a principal, and my having received that travel expense, even though it comes through a 501c3 and isn't reportable on our statements of economic interest, is something I would have to do. It's simply a sunlight and disclosure so that folks know who's working on legislation, promoting policy, and paying for that to happen. It's in keeping with the spirit of all of our campaign finance and public disclosure laws.
Further discussion to the A2 amendment, Senator Vandeveer.
Senator Dibble, I haven't seen this amendment before, but it does look like it significantly expands what this bill impacts, and it would be good to know who was impacted by your amendment and under what circumstances, and all of that would be designed to be taken care of in the committee process. So at this juncture, I guess I can't support your amendment.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam President, and I'd like to request a roll call on this amendment. And I agree, Senator Vandeveer, committee process is ideal. Fortunately, the committee process isn't typically available to members of the minority party. I requested committee hearings, multiple committee hearings, on all of my bills and received hearings on almost none of them. So I agree with you. Ideally, the committee process would be where we want to have a more full discussion about this. But it's a very simple bill, and it's in how it's construed. It's simply, it is as exactly how it reads. It impacts, frankly, us and those organizations that we seek model policy guidance from.
Roll call has been requested and a roll call granted. Further discussion on the A2 amendment, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Madam President, I would question the amendment on the grounds of germaneness. This is certainly going in a different and substantially different purpose that the bill was originally intended.
I
Further advice for the chair, Senator Dibble.
Madam President, I strenuously disagree with the question of germaneness and would request that you rule that this amendment is, in fact, germane. I think it's exactly in keeping. And as a matter of fact, Senator Vandeveer, in speaking about sunlight and disclosure, could have been speaking about the amendment that I was offering. It is absolutely in keeping with the reporting and the disclosure requirements that he was seeking to effect some change on.
Further advice for the chair? I am going to rule the A2 amendment non-germane, given that the underlying bill is very specific and the A2 amendment would be broadening the scope of the amendment, thus changing the purpose for a substantially different purpose.
Madam President.
Senator Dibble.
I appeal the ruling of the chair and request a roll call vote.
Senator Dibble has appealed the ruling of the chair. Under Rule 14.4, and I will read the rule, an appeal is decided by a majority vote of those present and voting. Upon an appeal from the decision of the President, the question is, shall the decision of the President be the judgment of the Senate? A green vote, you would agree with the ruling of the chair. A red vote, you would disagree with the ruling of the chair. The Secretary will take the roll. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the Secretary will close the roll. There being 34 ayes and 31 nays, the ruling of the chair has been sustained. Further discussion on Senate File 2334. Seeing none, the Secretary will give Senate File 2334 its third reading.
Senate File Number 2334, a bill for an act relating to lobbying, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 2334. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 64 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Moving to number 84 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 1911, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, Senate File 1911 is the Freedom to Hunt and Fish Act. It is one of those, quote, anti-shutdown bills, but I hope members will give it a little more thought. Article 13, miscellaneous subject section 12 of the Minnesota Constitution states, quote, hunting and fishing and the taking of game and fish are a valued part of our heritage that shall forever be preserved for the people and shall be managed by law and regulation for the public good. That was adopted November 3rd, 1998. Madam President, members, in my opinion, we violated our Minnesota Constitution last year when we did not allow people to buy fishing licenses during the shutdown to go fishing. I serve as state senator in central Minnesota in the Brainerd Lakes area, and I saw firsthand how people were hurt by our unwillingness to allow them to buy a fishing license. This is a Minnesota right, in my opinion. The DNR lost about $2 million in revenues from lost fees from fishing licenses during the shutdown, but the tourism industry lost far, far, far more than that. The DNR estimates that over 20,000 out-of-state fishing licenses were not purchased as a result of the shutdown. Many of those folks were coming to the many resorts in our state, but they never came. Crow Wing County Commissioners, that's where Brainerd is, tried to take proactive steps to avoid this. They passed a resolution urging the DNR to allow people to fish during the shutdown on an honor system in which they would then buy a license after the shutdown ended. Initially, the local DNR folks seemed willing to go along with this common sense solution. Later, the state DNR put the kibosh on that idea. I gotta tell you, I love the way local folks think. They find solutions. Keep in mind, these licenses are sold over the counter at many of your local gas stations and sporting goods stores, and they're purchased electronically. This bill is very simple in that if there was ever another shutdown, that fishing and hunting licenses could still be purchased electronically. This is supported by the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, MOHA, and I will stand for any questions.
Further discussion on Senate File 1911. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam President. This is another one of those bills where we're expecting government to not get its work done, and I encourage us to not support this. Why would we remove all consequences of the legislature not getting its work done? We should be encouraging resolution, not expecting it. Having these bills makes it easy to prolong budget discussions and not get the necessary work done to make our deadlines. So I encourage people to not support this. We should get our work done and not expect not to.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam President. And you're right. We are having this conversation more than once, but to say the people of Minnesota and the people from other states coming into here cannot fish in Minnesota seems ridiculous to me. We do need to get our work done, but we can work with the governor and the legislative bodies to do that. We do not have to allow the people of Minnesota to suffer while we're doing that.
Further discussion on Senate File 1911. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I would just add my voice to Senator McGuire's in saying that, in agreeing that we absolutely should not be in a situation where we're telling people who want to come into this state or are in this state that they cannot fish, especially those that are seeking assistance from our departments during a shutdown. The way to make it absolutely certain that that doesn't happen, however, is not to undermine the process of the legislature and its decision-making process. It is, in fact, to get our work done on time. And if this legislature had considered those things that we could do that would increase the probability of our getting our work done on time, we would be much further ahead than trying to pass these bills, like the one that is in front of us now, that will undermine our process. Getting our work done on time, increasing our conflict resolution skills, making it possible to get a bill together that the governor would sign, would in fact do what this bill purports its motivation is.
Further discussion, Senator DeCryf.
Thank you, Madam President. I would speak in support of this bill. I thank Senator Gazelka for bringing it forward. What this point in time right now is an opportunity for us to work together with the governor. And this is one piece of legislation that I believe that we should pass. We should work together with the governor and agree that the ability to buy fishing license and hunting license should be off the table if there's ever another state shutdown, no matter who is in charge of the legislature or the governor's mansion. So I speak in support of this bill, and I thank Senator Gazelka.
Further discussion, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I stand in support of this as well. Members, you know, this is, you know, there's been a lot of talk about these different bills when it comes to shutdown and we should get our work done and this and that. This is a little bit different in that, as you remember, maybe some of you remember that have been here for quite a few years, that this was a part of a constitutional amendment in Minnesota to be able to hunt, be able to have the right to hunt and fish in the state of Minnesota. So really, When you consider that, as well as when you consider that nearly 20,000 non-resident licenses went unpurchased because of the shutdown, that is a tremendous amount of revenue, members, that we lost during this shutdown. And yes, it was because that the bodies could not get their work done, but that does not mean that the people that have been planning to come here for upwards of 6 to 7 months, because I know they have to make that kind of reservations in different state parks throughout the state of Minnesota, and at the same time they're obviously looking at fishing opportunities when they're here, and to lose that kind of revenue is just totally irresponsible. And it's not that big of a fix to keep a few people on in the state of Minnesota during that very prime time for hunting and fishing and camping experiences in Minnesota, and it just seems to really make good sense. And I can't help but think that the administration will agree with this as well. So again, I stand in favor of this bill.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. And I couldn't agree more that it really doesn't make sense that we would go into a situation where people who want to come from other states can't buy their fishing licenses. I do think, however, that in relationship to what it costs the economy of this state to not have lights on bills for our public employees, people who will not be earning their income during the time that there is a shutdown, will not be able to pay the bills for their family members, will not be able to spend their dollars in the businesses in our small communities around the state and small businesses. There's nothing on a lights on bill that takes into account all of those dollars that need to be spent and earned by our people that work for the state of Minnesota. And yet, we are concerned about the economic impact of people from another state coming in buying fishing licenses. The solution to the problem doesn't lie in preparing for a shutdown and by reducing the consequences of a shutdown. The solution lies in our getting our work done on time, That is what the public has asked us to do, not to prepare for a shutdown, to avoid all these negative consequences, and not select who gets to not pay the consequences while we expect so many people, especially our public employees, to pay the price of our ineffectiveness in getting our work done. The way to respond to the problems that you're describing is to be effective in conflict resolution, and my bill, had it been heard or considered, would have assisted us in that process.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam President. I don't want to beat this to death either, but I one final irony that I found was that the courts allowed the DNR employment officials or enforcement officials to continue to do their job, but people couldn't buy a fishing license to fish legally. I thought that very, very strange.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to make sure that my constituents really understand the difference and understand why I will not vote for this. I think this is very, very important. It is our obligation to let our constituents know the difference. This is not a vote no on this bill. It's not that we are against fishing. It's not that we are against facilitating an opportunity for people to get a license to go fishing. A vote no on this is preventing from getting this right to this body to do the work. We need to get our work done, just like Senator Sharon just described. We need to get the work done and not to prepare for a shutdown. When we move all of these lights on bills, what we're doing is preparing for a shutdown and really making exceptions. People want their permits to do the electrical work in their homes. Of course they do. They want their licenses. That is the work that we need to get done now. We all need to vote on it, not make these exemptions so that some people will get the work done, some people will get licenses, and some other people will not. And then we will come back here, not having our work done, having our communities divided. So this is not helping us. We need to prepare to do our work by getting the legislation that we need to get done in place, not creating these divisions and doing these exceptions for these different licenses. So I urge members not to support this.
Senator Cohen.
Madam President, just a quick comment. Let's see, yesterday we passed a bill relative to correcting the school shift that was passed last year. Now we're passing another lights-on bill to correct what happened last year. I thought for all the talk about how great the session was last year, we wouldn't have to continue to pass corrective legislation correcting all the mistakes from last year. I don't expect a response. That's kind of a rhetorical comment. Just wanted to make it, though.
Further discussion on Senate File 1911. Secretary will give Senate File 1911 its third reading.
Senate File Number 1911, a bill for an act relating to natural resources, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 1911. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 41 ayes and 24 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Moving on to number 2 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 1140, Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam President. Senate File 1140, this bill clarifies existing law regarding the requirement that two license plates be displayed on most motor vehicles. Current law states one plate must be displayed on the front and one on the rear of the vehicle. Instead, this clarification states that plates must either be mounted on the front or rear bumpers of the vehicle, on the front and the back of the vehicle exterior, in places designed to hold license plates. It's a clarification of the law. It actually saves us money in the long run, but it does help clarify for the judicial side, the judges, if there is a ticket issued on this.
Further discussion on Senate File 1140. Senator Latz.
Madam President, will Senator Perry yield for a question?
Senator Perry will yield. Senator Latz.
Senator Perry, I think I caught what you said, but I'm trying to clarify. Did you say that this would allow license plates for automobiles to be to only be mounted on either the front or the back, but not requiring both?
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Latz, no, this is a requirement that focuses on the fact that the vehicles do have to have a plate on the front bumper and the rear, or on the front in areas designated by the manufacturer for license plate holders. So both front and back. And a little bit of further background, what happens here is in law enforcement, some people believe that they can put the plate in the windshield. Some people believe they don't have to have a front plate at all. And what happens is because the law is not clear enough, when that citation goes into court, we're finding that a third of those citations are dismissed by some of the judges because they don't believe the law clearly defines where that license plate should be.
Further discussion, Senator Tomasoni.
Madam President, I have an amendment, the A1 amendment.
Senator Tomasoni offers the A1 amendment. The Secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Tomasoni moves to amend Senate File 1140 as follows, page 1 after line 4, insert. This is the A1 amendment.
To the amendment, Senator Tomasoni.
Madam President, members, the amendment I have is a special plate for retired firefighters. I've spoken with the author, and he's amenable to this amendment. And this bill has passed out of the Finance Committee and is currently on general orders. The retired firefighters license plate is a special plate from the standpoint that when a firefighter retires and becomes a retired firefighter, they have to give up their firefighter's plate, and this allows them to get another plate. And because of the special revenue fund, there is no cost to the general fund on this, and I appreciate your support.
Further discussion to the A1 amendment, Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam President, and I would look at this as a friendly amendment.
Further discussion to the A1 amendment. Senator Kielash.
Madam Chair, will Senator Perry yield for a question?
Senator Perry will yield. Senator Kielash.
Senator Perry, one of the things that strikes me is that this may be all-encompassing. I'm wondering if there's an exception for the temporary paper plates that you need once in a while when you're buying a new vehicle, your plate hasn't come yet, that are usually taped in the back window. It's much to keep them out of the weather because they're paper while you're waiting for your license plate to come.
Excuse me, Senator, to the amendment, to the A1 amendment.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I'll wait for that.
Further discussion to the A1 amendment. Seeing none, Senator Tomasoni renews his motion to adopt the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Kielash, to the bill.
I apologize for that, Madam President. Senator Perry, will you yield for a question on this?
Senator Perry will yield. Senator Kielash.
Just my question has to do with temporary license plates, people that either have them stolen or they're waiting for the Department of Motor Vehicles to get a plate to them, or they've purchased a new car and their license plate isn't there when they buy it. How is this law going to affect those folks when they tape that temporary paper license to their windows?
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam President and Senator Kielash. This will have no effect on that. That is a temporary registration slip, and so this bill doesn't change that whatsoever.
Further discussion to Senate File 1140. Secretary will give Senate File 1140 its third reading.
Senate File Number 1140, a bill for an act relating to public safety, third reading.
Secretary will give Senate, will take the roll on Senate File 1140. All those senators having voted who desire to vote. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 55 ayes and 9 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Moving to number 85 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 1543, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam President. Last year, members, we passed and signed into law the Community Paramedics Bill, and it was a very good piece of legislation. Basically, we established the definition of community paramedic, which means they have to have a minimum of 2 years' experience as a paramedic. They need to successfully complete a formal training program at an accredited college or university, the MNSCU system. Their training would be provided under supervision of an ambulance medical director, an advanced practice registered nurse, or other medical professionals. We also said in the bill that we have to, this year, we have to come back and do specified services and payment rates for these services to be performed by community paramedics to be covered by medical assistance. So, Madam President and members, after many meetings this fall and, of course, going through the proper hearings, we came up with a piece of legislation, Senate File 1543, that exactly does that. It deals with the specifics of reimbursement under medical assistant and other state programs for this bill, but it also, and I want to just tip the hat off to the Department of Human Services. They were great to work with on this. Some of the key provisions is stating who would be an eligible recipient. An eligible recipient includes an individual who has received hospital emergency room services three or more times in four consecutive months in the past 12 months. Also, an eligible recipient must be identified by their primary health care provider and for whom the community paramedic services would likely prevent admission to or would allow discharge from a nursing facility or hospital. Payment for the community paramedic services must be part of a care plan ordered by a primary health care provider in consultation with the ambulance medical director. And the community paramedic services shall include health assessment, chronic disease monitoring, and education, medication compliance, immunization and vaccinations, laboratory specimen collection, hospital discharge follow-up care, and minor medical procedures approved by the ambulance medical director. The date that this would be affected would be this July 1st of 2012. Madam President and members, there is a cost savings to this because, as you all know, if when we have people that are constantly using the emergency room, and we affectionately call them frequent flyers, if we can get them on a care plan in coordination with their primary physician, we can do some wonderful things for them. We know that this has been a tremendously well received out in Greater Minnesota, but it's also gotten a lot of attention from the hospitals inside the metropolitan area, the seven county metropolitan area, especially Hennepin County Medical Center, because they know of these people that are chronically coming in to the emergency room. That is the biggest cost to these hospitals, is uncompensated care. I think that's something this bill will absolutely deal with in a very good way and create this ongoing care plan that we so needed. It's one of the first in the nation, members, and I feel really good about this bill, and I want to thank the people that have worked on it, not only the department, but all the Nurses Association and, of course, the lobbyists. And with that, I ask for your support.
Further discussion, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, I stand in support of Senate File 1543. Excuse me. Paramedics are an underutilized and important group of health care providers, especially in rural Minnesota. I saw firsthand as my experience as an emergency room nurse how important the paramedics are in the health care continuum. I also see that the bill has savings associated with it, and I believe that once this policy is fully implemented that we will see even greater savings. So, members, I encourage a green vote on Senate File 1543.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Madam President. And, you know, the salient points on this issue have been made, but I do want to rise in support of this as well as a member on the other side of the aisle and as also a member from a regional center. As Senator Rosen pointed out, this does have real impact in the more rural parts of the state, but it does have impact in the urban centers as well. And I applaud Senator Rosen, chief author on this bill, as well as the statewide EMS folks who have worked for several years in a row now to try and come up with something that we can have, you know, that really cliche peace in the valley term about, but this is finally a bill that everybody is supportive of. And as Senator Hoffman said as well, it allows folks that are out there doing emergency medicine to practice at the top of their license. It also allows them to get as close to the people who need the service as possible, and that is what we continually need to do in order to find savings within healthcare and control the cost. So I'm enthusiastically supportive of this bill.
Further discussion on Senate File 1543. Secretary will give Senate File 1543 its third reading.
Senate File Number 1543, a bill for an act relating to human services, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 1543. all those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 65 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Moving to number 34 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 1948, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, Senate File 1948 is a nursing facility rate equalization bill. We did have a bill last year that repealed the rate equalization structure in Minnesota altogether. This bill does not do that. This bill reflects the language that was in the House Senate Conference Committee report that was passed by this body last year. And what it does is it allows for the private pay patients to be charged up to 2% more per year above the Medicaid rate. Minnesota is one of only two states in the country, North Dakota being the other one, in which there is still a rate equalization law. These were laws that were passed a number of years ago, back when conditions and circumstances surrounding nursing home care were much, much different than they are today. North Dakota does still have this, but they also have a structure that the state does pay fully for the cost of nursing care. Minnesota does not. The costs that Minnesota pays to reimburse nursing care are about $28 less than the cost. That's our reimbursement rate. And so all this does, this current structure, is require that private pay patients who do have resources are not permitted to use those resources to pay the full cost of care, and they're required to pay at the same rate as the medical assistance rate is. So this is a provision that is supported by the long-term care imperative. It has, we think, it's time for Minnesota to do this, to become a part of most of the rest of the country in recognizing that private pay individuals who can't afford to pay the full cost ought to be permitted to do that. And let's not hold down the cost to nursing homes by imposing this on private pay. It may be a while before we're able to raise those reimbursement rates for the medical assistance patients or residents, and this would at least give the nursing facility some opportunity to recover some of the costs that they're currently having to absorb. So I urge your support for the bill.
Senator Marty.
Madam President, Senator Hand's bill is the wrong solution to the lack of funding for nursing homes. We ought to provide the funding for medical assistance rather than have a discriminatory rate. Minnesota has had the rate equalization for many years, and it's resulted in us making sure that we don't give second-class treatment to some seniors. And the nursing homes say, oh, we don't treat them differently now, but you can be sure that as they do, that people will get the notices that you're no longer, you've spent down your money. These are our neighbors, these are our friends, these are our parents. These are people who saved money and they're paying privately, and if we put this in place, they all eventually, or almost all of them, unless they're extremely wealthy, nursing homes can cost $70,000 plus a year. And they run out of money, and then they're told, well, we don't have room for you here as a medical assistance patient. We don't have that problem in Minnesota. It does not exist now. It's going to exist if we let this happen. This is the wrong solution to it. I think the AARP, the Seniors and Workers for Quality, and lots of others have spoken out strongly against this. We've been fighting this off every year. The only reason the nursing homes come in with Senator Hand's legislation is because the state is not keeping up its end of the bargain. But this is the wrong solution. Strongly urge you to oppose it.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam President. I have an amendment. It'll be the A53 amendment.
Senator Goodwin offers the A53 amendment. The Secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Goodwin moves to amend House Senate File Number 1948 as follows. Page 2 after line 26, insert. This is the A53 amendment.
To the amendment, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam President. What this amendment will do will say that the increase has to go to the direct line staff. So if they are going to get a private pay residents are going to get an increase in their rates, then that revenue must be used only for wages and benefits of staff providing direct care to residents, and it can't be used in place of other wage or benefit increases that would ordinarily be received by the workers. Folks, I got a lot of these great big nursing homes in my district, and they're all respectable and they're all good. But some of the staff I've heard of that are sleeping out in the parking lot because they can't afford housing. Other staff is working two and three jobs to just support their family because a lot of them are single parents. And it's time we really thought about what the value of their work is and really paid them for the value of their work. So if you're serious about doing this, then you need to be serious about making sure that the people that are directly involved in the care of our residents are getting a fair wage. I appreciate a yes vote on this. Thank you.
Further discussion on the A53 amendments. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam President. To the amendment, I would just urge members to reject the amendment. One of the things that we're trying to do with this is recognize that currently we are not able to reimburse the long-term facilities for the full cost, and all of the bill that we have in front of us would do is allow them to charge more for a private pay patient, 2% more than they would otherwise be required to charge under the current law. So this amendment would only restrict the flexibility of nursing care facilities to use whatever additional dollars they may receive, and so I would just urge members to reject it.
Senator Goodwin.
Madam President, I just want to request a roll call on this. Thank you.
Roll call has been requested. Roll call granted. Further discussion on the A53 amendment. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. I'd like to ask Senator Goodwin a question.
Senator Goodwin will yield. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Goodwin, in looking over your amendment, would this affect union line staff or is it non-union line staff?
Senator Goodwin.
Senator Limmer, Madam President, Senator Limmer, it would affect any staff that provides direct care to residents.
Senator
Limmer.
Madam President, then what we're doing by your amendment, at least for those that are unionized, is now we're interceding in collective bargaining elements by dictating and mandating to a business that if they happen to make a little extra money in order to keep their facility viable, that we're mandating that that money should go only to the workers that are working there. What if there's a leaky roof? What if there's need to be changing? What if the ADA requirement in the building needs to be improved upon? You know, what if there's a cost of pharmacy costs or other medical expenses that need to go up and this facility needs to raise more money? How would a business be able to pay for those essential life-saving requirements when all the money is dictated by the state of Minnesota to go elsewhere?
Senator Goodwin.
Well, Madam President, Senator Limmer, what would they do now? They don't have this 2% rate difference now, so what would they do now if those things happened? As a result of cutting the Medicaid reimbursement to nursing homes last year, they probably wouldn't be able to afford those things. But we got to fund this appropriately. We got to fund this the way it should be funded. Other states are making up for the funding with their Medicaid or other programs, and now we're not keeping up with what they need from us. So, and as far as union contracts go, this has nothing to do with the union contracts because they can still negotiate whatever they want to negotiate and whatever the administration will agree on for wages and benefits. This 2% would be above whatever the negotiated amount was. So, and I'm sure that wouldn't bring them over the top in their salary. It might just get them a little closer to a livable wage.
Senator Limmer.
Madam President, Senator Goodwin, if I could bring your attention to line 1.5 of your amendment. Your amendment states that the rate increase will be used only for the wages and benefits of staff. So we are interfering with union negotiations by this bill. You are writing a provision that supersedes collective bargaining rights, and we're now creating a mandate on a nursing home owner. That's exactly what your amendment says.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam President. And Senator Lemmer, you're wrong. Union contracts are usually a minimum amount of pay increase or benefits, and this would just say that, and it doesn't interfere with negotiations whatsoever. It just adds on to negotiations, and I think that's pretty clear in here, and won't be it for me, of all people, to put something in that would hurt the unions, as I've sat here for 2 years and watched this happen to working people over and over and over again, and it wasn't me who did it.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam President. And just wanted to make a small correction, Senator Goodwin. We did not cut any rates to nursing facilities in the budget last year. I just want to make that clear. You indicated that we had done that, but we did not do that in the budget last year.
Senator Hoffman. Senator Hoffman passes. Further discussion to the A53 amendment. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam President and Senator Hahn, but you did eliminate the rate basing.
Further discussion to the A53 amendment. A roll call has been requested. The Secretary will take the roll on the A53 amendment. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the Secretary will close the roll. There being 26 ayes and 39 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Further discussion to Senate File 1948. Senator Marty.
Madam President, I want to get back to something Senator Hahn said a couple minutes ago as part of the, in his comments on the amendment, and I think it refers to the whole point behind the bill not being the right solution. And I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember the exact words, but I think you said the state is not paying through Medicaid the cost of providing the service. We're not paying them adequately for what they're delivering. And I think you also said that you don't expect it to be those rates to be increased in the next few years. And I think those may be accurate statements in your mind. I'm not challenging that. I'm just saying that it's a pretty sad commentary. What a way to run a railroad. We're not going to pay people for what we're expecting them to do, and we're not going to fix it. So we're going to do these half-baked fixes instead. Our nursing homes are important parts of our state. They deserve the funding they need to take care of people in nursing homes. We ought to fix the problem instead of saying, we're not going to fix it. We know it's a problem. We're not going to fix it, though. Instead, we're going to let them charge discriminatory rates. This is a terrible solution. The real solution is to change what you said and instead provide the funding they need.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam President. And Senator Marty, I appreciate your comments. I just was commenting mostly as a reflection of the number of years that this situation has gone on. And contrary to what the opinion may be, it had nothing to do with Republicans being in the majority. This has been a long-standing issue for the state of Minnesota, that the reimbursement rates for nursing homes under Democrat control, as well as what we were able to do in our budget last year, was not able to provide the funds to bring those costs up. I think many of us would like to do that, but I think it is unlikely that we'll see that happen in the next year or maybe two, but it's something that I think many of us would like to work toward. However, in the meantime, it doesn't strike me that it's a fair thing to say to nursing homes that you should continue to charge people who can't afford to pay a cost that is lower than the actual cost of care. I think most people who have the resources, I believe, want to pay their full share. If you have resources and you are looking at buying something, I think you want to pay whatever the cost of that thing is. And to have a law in Minnesota that says if you have resources, you are not permitted to use those resources to pay even a slightly higher cost than what the law provides, I think that's not fair, that's not right. And what this bill does is allow for that private pay rate to be increased gradually 2%. And there is nothing to, there are state laws and there are federal laws that prevent any kind of discriminatory care. We're not talking about trying to provide a higher level of care. All we're talking about is allowing people who have the resources to pay more of the true cost of that care rather than being required, as the state law does currently, to prevent that from occurring. So I would encourage support of the bill.
Senator Goodwin.
Madam Chair, I have another amendment at the desk. It is the A-52 amendment.
Senator Goodwin offers the A-52 amendment. The Secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Goodwin moves to amend Senate file number 1948 as follows. Page 1, delete line 20-24. This is the A-52 amendment.
To the amendment, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam President. What this amendment would do would allow the 2% increase for just the 1 year, but delete the sections that gives it in consecutive years and after October 1st, 2013 allows another increase, and then is whatever year after year on that. So it's basically on automatic pilot on our private pay patients with the bill Senator Hahn is offering. And I think maybe next year is another budget year, and hopefully the budget will be doing better and we can reimburse our homes the way they're supposed to be reimbursed and not depend on the private pay patients to catch up for all the problems that we've made for the nursing homes here by not funding them appropriately. So I think we need to take another look at it next year, do it for 1 year, take another look at it next year, and see if we can afford to do better funding of our nursing homes from the state level. And I'd like a roll call vote on this, too.
Roll call has been requested. Roll call granted. Further discussion to the A-52 amendment. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam President, and members, I'd urge your no vote on this amendment. This bill, as it's written, does allow the private pay patients to pay up to 2% more than the current mandated Medicaid reimbursement rate. This is not a windfall. This is just allowing patients who have the resources to pay slightly more toward the full cost. They're still not going to be paying the full cost. And so I think that the bill, as it's written, is adequate, and I'd urge a no vote on the amendment.
Senator Kielash.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, just a point of clarification. You're saying that the 2%, this bill will allow patients to pay the up to 2% more. Do you really mean that it allows the nursing homes to charge more, or are we saying this is a voluntary thing on the part of those folks that are paying out of their own pocket?
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam President. It is voluntary on the part of the nursing homes to be able to charge more to private pay patients who can afford that extra cost or the extra amount. It does not raise the cost of the care. All it does is reflect that the current state law requires that they charge a lower rate than the true cost of care. And I'm not sure why you are concerned or others are concerned that this shouldn't be permitted. If you have resources and you can pay the true cost of your care, why should you not be permitted to do that or be invited to do that? Why should we say, no, we're going to prevent you from paying the true cost of your care. We're going to hold you to the Medicaid reimbursement rate that is low, as it has been discussed over a number of years. The legislature has not seen fit for whatever reason to raise those reimbursement rates, and so they are low. And that problem is probably going to persist for at least for the next year or two. And all this bill does is allow people who have resources to be able to pay more, that the nursing home may offer a higher rate, but a rate that still would not recover the full cost of care.
Further discussion to the A52 amendment. Secretary will take the roll on the A52 amendment. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 27 ayes and 38 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 1948. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, I stand in support of Senate File 1948. I remember as a young child my great-grandfather being cared for in my grandparents' home. And was it hard? Yes, it was. But it was something that a family does. And over the course of my life, I have watched as government has intruded more and more on what families should be doing for their elderly. So I would ask this question. It's maybe rhetorical. Maybe somebody on the other side of the aisle can answer it for me. With everything we've seen coming down from the federal government, the state government, and how much more of our health care and our families are being taken over by government funding, where does the family fit into this? Where does the family's decision-making process fit into this? And how did we do it before we had so many government programs? It was from the family. It was from the nuclear family. And I think we're going to have to start having that larger discussion, because these costs are spiraling out of control. Our nursing homes are not able to keep up. And we're forgetting about where families come, not just with our children, but also with our elderly. So I would support Senator Hand's bill, and I would ask that all members also do that. And let's start having that larger discussion about families and caring for our parents and our grandparents.
Further discussion to Senate File 1948. Secretary will give Senate File 1948 its third reading.
Senate File Number 1948, a bill for an act relating to human services, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 1948. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 38 ayes and 26 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Moving to number 108 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 1621, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam President and members. Today before us, we have Senate File 1621. This is a bill concerning the modification of child care accreditation provisions and process. The legislation requires that the Commissioner of Human Services, in conjunction with the Commissioner of Education and Health, develop eligibility criteria for the accreditation standards for child care centers in order to receive the provider rate differential. In the legislation, we've given them an absolutely fantastic framework to work off of, about eight provisions in there. They will also be in charge of reporting back to the legislature on the application and approval process that they're going to move forward with. The deadline to have this done by in the legislation is February 15th of 2013. The current criteria will remain in effect until the approval process is implemented. The legislation allows for a consistent and uniform accreditation process, taking specifically named schools out of statute and instead implementing an accreditation process by which more schools can be accredited. In short, the reason we need to do this is in statute right now, we have names of certain schools. These schools go out of business. We have actually, in statute, one of them is even mislabeled. So one of the folks that was working with me on this legislation went out and actually registered an LLC under the name of one of these groups that's in statute. So that's kind of one of the reasons we want to move away from that process. We have some great support here from the Minnesota Child Care Association, the Minnesota Association for the Education of Young Children, and also the Minnesota School Age Care Alliance. So I would appreciate a green vote, and we'll stand for any questions.
Further discussion, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam President. Would Senator Cruz yield for a question?
Senator Cruz will yield. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you. Senator Cruz, would this bill have any impact on previous legislation that was regarding the QRIS system? In that legislation, we actually allowed Head Start and school readiness programs to have an automatic 4-star. I know we have since revisited that policy, but I just want to know if that particular provision in previous statute has any relationship to this current proposal.
Senator Cruz.
Madam President and Senator Bonoff, I do not believe it does. They would still continue to move forward and be able to go through the process.
Further discussion, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam President. Would Senator Cruz yield for a question?
Senator Cruz will yield. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Madam President, Senator Cruz, I appreciate that you mentioned the people that were supporting the bill. I'm not on the committee that was hearing it. Was there anyone that spoke in opposition to the bill? Were there people that were concerned about this?
Senator Cruz.
Well, Madam President and Senator McGuire, if I'm remembering correctly, this was brought out a voice vote out of two committees, the Education Committee and the Health and Human Services Committee. We've worked very, very hard in conjunction with also the Department of Health. Though they're remaining neutral on the bill, we worked very closely with them to shape the language in a fashion that they felt they could best work with it.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam President. And so this did not come from them, but it was felt that the department could live with the bill. Would that be an accurate representation of this issue?
Senator Cruz.
Madam President and Senator McGuire, yes.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Further discussion on Senate File 1621. Secretary will give Senate File 1621 its third reading.
Senate File Number 1621, a bill for an act relating to human services, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 1621. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 63 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Moving to number 43 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 1835, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, Senate File 1835 is a bill that focuses on the welfare eligibility residency requirements, and if passed, would change the waiting period from 30 days to 60 days for people moving to Minnesota and applying for welfare assistance. Everyone has a constitutional right to travel, and we want to encourage people to come to Minnesota looking for work. This bill encourages people to find a job if they want to come to Minnesota. The state of Minnesota has an interest in people working in Minnesota. The latest statistics that I have on your desk, gathered by the revisor's office, they came in February, but the statistics are 2010, show that 25% of MFIP cases, Minnesota Family Investment Program cases, were open for people moving to Minnesota. 25%. That's a growing number, members. The prior year numbers were 19%, a little over 19%. In addition, 30.2% for DWP, displaced workers, and 13.1% for general assistance. These numbers are substantially higher than the estimates that DHS gave during testimony, but DHS did not contest my figures, but said it may also include people moving to Minnesota from other countries as well as other states. Attempts to change the waiting periods to 6 months or longer have been rejected by various courts across the country, but courts in Wisconsin have upheld Wisconsin's language for a 60-day waiting period. Their Supreme Court stated that the 60-day waiting period was substantially less onerous than the 12-month waiting period, which was found to be in violation of the constitutional right to travel. Further, the court stated that while the waiting period did treat non-residents differently than residents, to do so was not in violation of the Equal Protection Clause because the state had a reasonable objective of encouraging individuals to support themselves through employment. Even though this bill only addresses MFIP and GA, there are numerous other programs available to individuals and families, and when comparing them together, Minnesota is more generous than our neighboring states. The fiscal note on this was zero, but there would be savings from this, but it was zero because there would potentially be a court challenge to this legislation. And finally, I'll close and just say again, everyone has a constitutional right to travel, and we want to encourage the people coming to Minnesota to look for work. This bill encourages that, and members, I ask for your support. Thank you.
Further discussion of Senate File 1835.
Madam President.
Senator Lurie.
Madam President, would Senator Gazelka yield for a question?
Senator Gazelka will yield. Senator Lurie.
Senator Gazelka, this estimate from the revisor of statutes, they're not typically the entity that puts together statistics for us in the DHS world. And are these the same statistics that you brought? Because I do remember, if I'm recalling correctly, DHS coming in and actually raising significant questions as to whether these were the right statistics or not. I haven't heard any follow-up myself, but I'm not quite clear on where the revisor got this, and I do recall significant questions being raised in committee from DHS on these numbers, and I'm just wondering if these are the same ones that those questions were raised on.
Senator Gazelka.
Madam President, Senator Lurie, that is correct, and if you recall in committee when we had a first discussion, their numbers were substantially lower, somewhere around 13 or 14%. And that's why I presented this in front of them with Mr. Tugut, I believe was his name, and he looked at the numbers and said perhaps he didn't reject the numbers that the revisor's office brought forth. He said perhaps they included people moving in from other countries or other situations. That's as far as I can go on that. But regardless, the number is high, members, whether it's 13% or 25%, that's a large number.
Senator Latz.
Madam President, will Senator Gazelka yield to a question?
Senator Gazelka will yield. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Gazelka, what year was the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision that you cited on the floor for the proposition that this kind of a residency requirement is constitutional?
Senator Gazelka.
Madam President, Senator Letts, it was, I believe, more than 10 years ago. We did have conversation about that in our in the Judiciary Committee as well.
Senator Letts.
Madam President, Senator Gazelka, would it refresh your memory if I told you it was a 1992 decision 20 years ago?
Senator Gazelka.
Madam President, thank you, Senator Letts, for that refresher.
Senator Letts.
Madam President, Senator Gazelka, are you aware of any United States Supreme Court decision on a also on a residency durational requirement that was issued since the Wisconsin Supreme Court issued its decision?
Senator Gazelka.
You know, we have debated this before, and you know the time frame. Though a factor, I believe it's the Wheat case that Obamacare, or excuse me, the Affordable Health Care Act is using as an older case than this. In the end, in the Judiciary Committee, there was definitely the thought that this may be challenged, but that doesn't mean that it should not be challenged and that it's not the right piece of legislation.
Senator Letts.
Madam President, I'm afraid I didn't hear an answer to my question, but I'll supply it. The United States Supreme Court in 1999 ruled a durational residency requirement unconstitutional. Will Senator Gazelka yield to another question?
Senator Gazelka will yield. Senator Letts.
Senator Gazelka, which court trumps the other, the United States Supreme Court or the Wisconsin Supreme Court?
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam President. I think we all know the answer to that, Senator Letts, and we don't have to play that game. What I would say is this is a situation or an issue that has not been declared by the courts to be unconstitutional at 60 days. The only documentation we have is that when it was tried before the courts a while ago, that they upheld it at that time.
Senator Letts.
Madam President, members, Senator Gazelka appears to be playing the game by not giving us the full information here, by asserting that this is a constitutional bill and citing for that proposition a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision. Well, members, I have to tell you that the United States Supreme Court in 1999 issued a decision in Sains versus Roe in which they declared the California durational residency requirements unconstitutional. And they did so in their analysis by stating that that the standard for review of the appellate courts was one of strict scrutiny. Strict scrutiny, the highest standard of review, the highest bar that a law must overcome in order to be considered constitutional. And it declared in that case that the California law did not meet that high standard. Well, members, the Wisconsin Supreme Court used a different standard of review. They used the lowest constitutional standard of review, that of a rational basis. So the standard of review that the Wisconsin Supreme Court used has been explicitly ruled wrong by the United States Supreme Court. And in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court said it wasn't appropriate to use the rational basis, and it wasn't even appropriate to use some intermediate standard of review. The standard of review that applies to durational residency requirements dealing with the right to travel is strict scrutiny. And in reaction to that U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1999, the Wisconsin department that administers that program
in the state of Wisconsin, the executive branch agency, their welfare department, if you will, issued a finding that they would no longer enforce the Wisconsin law because it would violate the United States Constitution to do so. So since 1999, despite what Senator Gazelka would have you believe, through Republican and Democratic governors in Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin has not enforced their 60-day durational residency requirement because, in their view, it is unconstitutional. And that is exactly what you would be voting for here today if you were to support this bill, is a clearly unconstitutional provision. Now, members, I guess you can do that if you wish, but it would just point out the pure politics of this bill and the absence of serious policy behind the bill that is being presented to us today. And members, that constitutional infirmity is precisely what underlies the fiscal note that Senator Gazelka has said to us comes up zeros. Well, it comes up zeros not because, as he said, there is some question about the bill. It comes up zeros because the fiscal analysts state that it is likely, but not certain, that the state would be enjoined by the courts from implementing the new residency requirements. Likely that it would be unconstitutional. I think they're couching their phrase a little bit carefully there because the constitutional law on this is quite clear, members. And in fact, they do specifically state this change in statute increases the risk of litigation. Now, that litigation would indeed carry costs, actual fiscal costs, related to the cost of litigation and the cost of resolving any litigation. I'm reading this right out of the fiscal note, members, that Senator Gazelka cited to you. So this bill would cost the taxpayers of Minnesota the extensive legal costs relating to defending it, if it were to become law, through the trial court, the Minnesota Court of Appeals, the Minnesota Supreme Court, and potentially the United States Supreme Court. Several years of litigation, several years of multiple staff at the Attorney General's office working on this, and depending on how the matter is handled from an implementation standpoint at the conclusion of the litigation, possibly reimbursement for people who would have been unlawfully deprived of the benefits that they had applied to receive. So let's not pretend that this is a cost-free bill in front of us today. If you vote for this bill, you are voting to spend taxpayer dollars on a flight of fancy.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. President, let me just follow up Senator Latz's very well-reasoned argument and make it clear to members, and Senator Gazelka, I hope you'll pay attention to this, because I think you made a comment relative to the question and answer with Senator Latz that understands that maybe there might be a challenge or maybe there might be some court litigation. No, not maybe. There absolutely will be litigation. And if I would disagree with Senator Latz in any part of his remarks, it would be that it's very clear when you read the Sands case that this is not an issue that's going to be resolved by the Minnesota Supreme Court or by a trial court in Ramsey County. This is U.S. Supreme Court dictum. And
in the same way that the Supreme Court has not overturned Plessy v. Ferguson or Brown versus Board of Education, I mean, pick any of the cases, this was a case decided, as Senator Latz pointed out, in 1999, I believe on a 7-2 vote. It is established law. To change this and change the established legal dictum in regard to durational residency for these benefits, you would have to go to the U.S. Supreme Court to do so. A lawyer 1 year out of law school can get the bill in front of us, if it becomes law, overturned quite easily by any court. But ultimately, it's going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court if you want this to succeed. And the Supreme Court, to overturn, would have to overturn what is the well-established precedent they established approximately 13 years ago. To get the U.S. Supreme Court to do that is a real stretch. The Supreme Court does not overturn its precedent-established decisions unless there is some incredible, compelling reason. And I made reference to the two cases that are the bookends. Plessy v. Ferguson, which in the 1890s said that separate but equal was sufficient relative to some of the Southern Jim Crow laws. We actually discussed those on the floor on Friday night. And then Brown v. Board of Education, of course, was the legislation or the Supreme Court decision in 1954 that said otherwise. But if you read the Brown decision, it goes after the Plessy decision in not a circuitous way, but makes it very clear as to why that decision of approximately 65 years previous was obsolete. To get the Supreme Court to do that is a huge, huge, huge leap. And since the legislation in front of us right now, Senator Kazalka's bill, Senate File 1835, is in no way a leap from where things were with Wisconsin, things were with California, or what we tried to do before here in Minnesota, there, I would agree with Senator Latz, could not see any way in the world that the U.S. Supreme Court would move away from what they very firmly held was their strict scrutiny standard in looking at this durational residency requirement. The Supreme Court has ruled this. Senator Latz is absolutely correct, and I can tell you as the former chair of the Finance Committee, one of the things that was always of great concern is when we found ourselves in some major litigation and the cost that would be a consequence of that. I'm trying to think of somewhere mid-90s, 20 years ago, when the treaty negotiations with the Mille Lacs Band broke down and the state was forced to go to litigation. I knew, and others knew, that it would in all likelihood be unsuccessful, but at huge expense to the state of Minnesota. That's exactly what happened. It was huge expense, and nothing changed from where it had been prior to the onset of the litigation. This case is even more clear-cut, because it's not in any way a case of first impression. The Blacks case wasn't either, but because it involved a little bit of a separate issue, you could have made the smaller argument that it was. This is not a piece of legislation that is in any way a case of first impression. Inevitably, as Senator Latz pointed out, we will be faced with litigation, we'll be faced with expensive litigation, and for no good purpose other than have a political vote right now on the floor of the Senate. Senator Gazelka, you suggested yesterday in response to my concerns about Senator Olson's bill that the job done last year was simply amazing and that we should go on from there. Well, Senator Gazelka, this bill doesn't go on from anywhere. Instead, it looks backwards, and we know exactly what the end result will be. It'll be a rejection of this legislation at significant cost to the state of Minnesota.
Further discussion on Senate File 1835, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just want to very briefly respond to the arguments by Senator Cohen, Senator Latz, and they very well may be correct in terms of their arguments as to the constitutionality In truth, we just never know. And I have stated in committee many times that it really isn't our job to try and anticipate what an appellate court is going to do and legislate from a standpoint of what may or may not be unconstitutional, because quite honestly, we all may have an opinion on any given issue, but in reality, our opinion doesn't count. The only opinion that counts is those judges that are sitting in the appellate court. And so from a standpoint of legislation, I would urge you not to legislate from a standpoint of fearing that what you are voting on may or may not be constitutional. And to support that argument, I would say this. The United States Supreme Court has been wrong in the past. Absolutely wrong. Senator Cohen has just given you a cite on two cases, the Plessy case and Brown versus the Board of Education. You can go all the way back to the Dred Scott decision. How can anybody possibly argue that that was a good, honest, sincere decision that the Supreme Court got it right? So maybe in this instance, the Supreme Court is wrong. I don't know. And that, of course, is why we as legislators do our job, and we enact laws, and the court does their job and reviews them from a standpoint of constitutionality. But I don't think anybody can, with any degree of definiteness, stand on the Senate floor and say something is absolutely going to be unconstitutional or is unconstitutional, because we simply do not know that.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. President. I think there's a strong temptation on the part of lawyers in this body occasionally to revert to their legal arguments. But what we have is a bill that includes public policy. And so I'm sure that a bill like this, if passed and signed, will get litigated, but I don't think we should do it here on the Senate floor. And there may be good legal reasons to vote no, Senator Cohen and Senator Latz, very good lawyers, but I think there are some good public policy reasons to consider Senator Gazelka's bill. And I think from a public policy point of view, it makes sense to say that if we are going to ask Minnesota taxpayers to provide benefits, then we should try and make sure that it's Minnesotans that we're benefiting. And I know it's a very complicated legal argument. It may or may not win, but I support Senator Gazelka's effort as a public policy matter to ensure as best we can that we are providing benefits to Minnesotans.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam President. And I rise in opposition to this bill. I think my colleagues that are lawyers have made quite an eloquent case of why this provision of this bill, if signed into law, won't work. But I want to make a different case. I want to make a case on who this affects, that this primarily affects women and children in Minnesota. The benefits that you get from the Minnesota Family Investment Program. Members, that is the name of the program. It is not the Minnesota Welfare Program. It is the Minnesota Family Investment Program. And if I say it maybe one more time, Minnesota Family Investment Program, it'll stick, because that is what we call the program that we distribute public assistance benefits in the state of Minnesota. The program not only provides cash benefits, it also provides benefits through the SNAP program, which used to be called the food stamp program. But what it also does is it also provides job counseling amenities. It allows people, and forces actually people, to go out and look for jobs. It makes them utilize our workforce development centers and centers through DEED, and says that you must go to work, or you must look for work, or you must have work-like opportunities and activities if you are in this program. And so I think that often there is a misnomer that this program simply just gives people money so that they can sit around and do nothing, and it's quite the contrary. People have to go out and successfully get trained and go for work. Now, one of the things that when we talked about this in committee, Senator Gazelka, when we asked him why, he talked about what usually happens in these bills is that someone in his district witnessed somebody who they thought was using the program inappropriately. That's typically what happens in this situation, is it isn't based on fact. It isn't based on a problem. It isn't based on someone from one of our county fraud enforcement organizations saying that, hey, there's a problem with this program. It's usually a constituent, which we appreciate. We listen to our constituents each and every day. But it's typically an isolated incident in which someone who may or may not know the rules of the program thinks that someone may or may not be breaking the rules. And members, I don't think that that's enough for us to change statute, go through a protracted and long legal debate because of that particular reason. The other thing that I will say about this particular bill is that though Senator Gazelka, there are numbers that come from the revisor, that come from DHS, that conflict with each other, one of the things that's clear is that the border states around us don't give out more cash benefit than we do. So I want to strike down this issue of Minnesota being a welfare magnet, because that's kind of what we always hear in this issue. And I'm not saying that because Senator Gazelka has said that today, but I'm saying that that's the underlying premise of this. Now, when you put benefits together, including the SNAP program and maybe others, there could be some a benefit to someone that goes there that signs up for each and everything. But the premise that people that come to Minnesota to get cash assistance on the Minnesota Family Investment Program get more than the surrounding states is wrong. So I don't see a reason for this. I don't see where there is a problem. I don't see where there is an issue. At any time, members, we can get somebody that tells us that they think that somebody is potentially doing wrong. But we have not gotten any indication from the evidence that suggests that this is an issue. The other thing that DHS says each and every year is that the amount of people who leave Minnesota who are on public assistance versus the people who come in is flat. In other words, there is not a net difference in people coming in that makes this program grow. The amount of people who leave and go back home or move to another state versus the people that come in is negligible. So the issue here is, are we going to put something in statute that we know is liable to be litigated? Are we going to punish people who have come to this state, maybe from just across the border, looking for work, maybe taking care of a family member, maybe looking for opportunity in this great state? Or are we going to say, let's get about the business of creating jobs? Are we going to move forward so that we can figure out how we get health care? Can we get the opportunity to create affordable housing? Can we move Minnesota forward? Or we continue to look back, stigmatize people, and really fall into a place that says that somehow we're a welfare magnet?
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam President. If I can respond to that briefly, you know, as far as Senator Hayden's comments about Minnesota being a welfare magnet, whether that's his position or others, is really not what this bill is about. That can be debated in the public square. This bill is focused on the state's interest of people coming to Minnesota looking for work. And, you know, I'm not an attorney, but I think I do understand common sense. And if we have a growing number of MFIP cases and GA cases or medical assistance cases, that we have an issue that we need to take a look at. And certainly 25% of new cases being paid out to people moving here is something I think we need to pause at. We know that 30 days is, quote, constitutional. But we don't know that 60 days is not also constitutional. Nowhere that I could see has 60 days ever been rejected by the courts. Nowhere that I can see. Senator Latz talked about a likely court case, and then he changed court case to likely unconstitutional. Well, the information was likely court case, not likely unconstitutional. And we know that there may be that challenge. But that doesn't mean that this isn't common sense. And if you look at, ask the average Minnesotan about this, I think you'd find that they would say that's common sense. Thank you.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam President. This is partly in response to Senator Ortman's questioning of the legal debate that is going on the Senate floor here, and I just need to make it clear on the record that the reason this legal debate needs to happen on the Senate floor is that Senator Gazelka insists on continuing to rely on this 1992 Wisconsin Supreme Court case that explicitly uses the wrong standard according to the U.S. Supreme Court. And so when we use a rationale to support our policy that has been clearly overruled by the U.S. Supreme Court, it needs to be challenged on this Senate floor. We can't allow arguments that bear no weight any longer to be used in support of an argument on the Senate floor. And that's why we are in this debate. Yet again, I will say, we spent two entire Health and Human Service hearings on this bill and went over this ground twice in great detail. And so we're bringing a bill up on the Senate floor that is widely understood to not be able to be implemented. And I guess, you know, one other thing that Senator Ortman had to say was that this, kind of the purpose of this, was to save the taxpayers from having to pay. Well, then would Senator Ortman yield for a question?
Senator Ortman will yield. Senator Lurie.
I see you nodding your head no. I heard you say, I thought, that this was for the benefit of the taxpayers, to make sure that our money is spent wisely. And if that is the purpose and the interest at stake here for the state of Minnesota to save money, that's clearly not a compelling interest in all of the decisions regarding the constitutionality of residence requirements for public assistance. And so I guess I'd just like to get clear on exactly what is the state interest that we're trying to protect here, because I did hear you talk about the benefit of the taxpayers and making sure that we don't give benefits to people who just came here.
Senator Ortman.
Well, Madam President, I'm not sure which was the question and which was the mischaracterization of what I said. But what I said was that it is, I believe, good public policy to say if we are going to raise the taxes to pay for benefits, then they should probably go to Minnesota residents. That's what I said, and I still stand by that. We're trying to confirm that Minnesota residents get the benefit of these programs, and I think that is the state's interest here.
Senator Lurie.
Well, I guess, Senator Ortman, that's very hard to distinguish from saving money. I mean, to protect the taxpayers and saving money, I just have a hard time understanding the difference that you're trying to draw, and we'll have to disagree on that.
Senator Latz.
Madam President, just to set the record straight about the fiscal note from what Senator Gazelka just referred to, I'm simply going to quote right out of Senator Gazelka's bill's fiscal note. It is likely but not certain that the state would be enjoined by the courts from implementing the new residency requirements. So the term likely, members, was used to refer to the likelihood that the state would be prohibited by the courts from implementing this legislation should it become law. It did not make reference to the risk of litigation in that term.
Secretary will give Senate File 1835 its third reading.
Senate File Number 1835, a bill for an act relating to human services, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 1835. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 35 ayes and 28 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Moving to number 53 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 2173, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam President and members. Before us, we have Senate File 2173, a bill concerning automated drug distribution systems. This bill authorizes the use of an automated drug distribution system in certain healthcare facilities. Current drug dispensing systems in many facilities require manual counting, sorting, checking, and distributing of medication. This bill would allow machines monitored by the Board of Certified Pharmacists to dispense medication. These medication dispensers are actually in use in many long-term care facilities right now. They are able to do that by a variance that's given to them by the Board of Pharmacies, and they've had a lot of great success. I'd like to take just a quick moment and go through what some of that is. These distribution machines have proven to increase resident safety and quality of care. The most advanced barcode and microchip packaging techniques enhances the accuracy at every step in the process. These machines improve resident comfort and satisfaction. This remote dispensing will eliminate long waits and allow nurses to administer medication within minutes, significantly improving patient comfort. These machines increase one-on-one time between nurses and residents. These remote dispensers can decrease the staff hours required to distribute medication by up to 75%, allowing the nursing staff to spend more time with their residents. These machines prevent medication theft. These remote dispensers ensure down-to-the-dose accountability for every single pill, significantly reducing the risk of medication theft. The machines reduced wasteful spending on unused medication. This is particularly important when we talk about things like Medicare and Medicaid. Essentially, what these machines do is if you're not using one of these machines, you have to go to a pharmacy, you get your prescription filled, and they come out in these bubble cards with all the doses that would be needed for a significant period of time. If that changes, then that medication gets thrown away, which equates to waste. So this helps reduce that. These machines protect Minnesota's environment by minimizing the amount of packaging and things that would go into our landfills. And then finally, very simply, brings 21st century technology to Minnesota's long-term care systems. This remote dispensing will complement the expertise of board-certified pharmacists with modern pharmaceutical technology in all of our long-term care facilities. So with that, I will stand for any questions, Madam President.
Further discussion on Senate File 2173. Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Madam President, and I have the A50 amendment.
Senator Saxog has offered the A50 amendment. The Secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Saxog moves to amend Senate File 2173 as follows, page 1 after line 4, insert. This is the A50-50 amendment.
To the amendment, Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, this amendment will allow the Little Fork Medical Center to continue to operate their pharmacy. For the last 6 years, the Board of Pharmacy allowed a variance for the medical center to dispense medication to patients and residents of the facility. This language allows for the medical center to use the doctor on staff, who would be licensed by the board, and a certified pharmacy technician to continue to provide the pharmacy needs of the patients. This amendment would establish a limited service pharmacy in a health professional shortage area designated by the federal government. Little Fork qualifies in this regard. The Board of Pharmacy would still have to approve the license, and it would need to be renewed annually. The staff from the Board of Pharmacy worked with Senate Council to create this language so that all concerns were addressed, and it would still have to be approved if passed. The Little Fork Medical Center was also involved in all the discussions and has agreed to the language. This passed through Health and Human Services, was sent to the floor without dissenting votes, and I have talked with the author of 2173. I would appreciate support and stand for questions.
Further discussion, Senator Cruz.
Madam President and members, I have spoken to Senator Saxhog about this. I have looked at the language. Looks like great policy. I would consider this a friendly amendment and look forward to championing this language moving forward.
Further discussion to the A50 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Saxhog renews his motion that Senate File 2173 be amended by the A50 amendment. All in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Further discussion of Senate File 2173. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Would the author yield for a question?
Senator Cruz will yield. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Cruz, is this the bill that allows dispensing drug systems like this to be used in correction facilities?
Senator Cruz.
Madam President and Senator Limmer, I believe we took that language out in Health and Human Services.
Thank you.
Further discussion on Senate File 2173. Secretary will give Senate File 2173 its third reading.
Senate File Number 2173, a bill for an act relating to health, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 2173. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 65 ayes and no nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Moving to number 55 on the general orders calendar, Senate File 2014, Senator Cruz.
Madam President, could I just quickly make a point of personal privilege?
Senator Goodwin, state your point of personal privilege.
I don't want to forget, so I want to do it now. You know, I've got three committees all at the same time tomorrow, and I had three committees all at the same time last week.
Senator Goodwin, would this be more appropriate under announcements of Senate interest? I mean, we're in the middle of special orders.
Okay, I'll wait. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Goodwin. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam President and members. We have before us Senate File 2014, bill concerning the Met Council. Currently, Met Council members serve at the pleasure of the governor, and their terms end with his. This bill would stagger the council members' terms, four-year terms. The Office of the Legislative Auditor suggested staggered terms for council members in a 2011 report. The OLA wrote, staggered terms would give the council more independence from the governor, would provide some stability for the council, and would enable the council to implement a more unified, strategic vision for the region. The reform was also recommended by the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government. The LCMG is tasked with overseeing the council and providing recommendations to the legislature. I do sit on that council. This was one of the recommendations moving forward. Essentially, all this does is pretty much keeps everything in place other than the fact that it staggers half of the 16 members. So there would be 8 and 8. The governor would still be able to appoint the chair at will and therefore kind of direct the momentum of the council.
Further discussion of Senate File 2014. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam President. Madam President and members, Senator Cruz, I certainly agree that there's been a lot of discussion about reforming the Metropolitan Council and its governance structure and some of its duties and responsibilities, et cetera. And I think there's a widely shared agreement that the Met Council as currently constituted perhaps needs some measure of greater accountability and greater connection to the metropolitan region in which it serves, and currently how it's constituted maybe doesn't provide for that. Senator Cruz, even though this idea has been in front of us previously, I think Senator Salzman had a bill a couple of years ago, and I know Senator Rest has discussed this staggered terms concept. I think this doesn't even get us very close to what we're really, what there seems to be broad agreement, a lot of disagreement about how exactly we get there, but broad agreement about what we're actually trying to accomplish with Metropolitan Council reform. What I fear, Senator Cruz, is that under this proposal that you have, it would be a minor change, wouldn't have the effect that you're seeking, and in fact might move us a little bit further away from that level of accountability that we're seeking as a region, as legislators, et cetera. Specifically, you know, what could conceivably happen is we would have fully half of the Met Council appointed, go through the process, but then serve, you know, and then we have a new governor come in. Those Met Council members, half of those Met Council members, are serving a specified term. And other than the malfeasance, nonfeasance, et cetera, removal provision, there's no ability to really hold them to account in any way, shape, or form, either by the incoming governor or by the sitting legislature, because you take out the language of serving at the pleasure of the governor and don't provide really any other mechanisms vis-a-vis the appointment process for that level of accountability that I think we all are seeking. And so, you know, we could envision a scenario in which there could be gridlock with simply the chair of the Met Council serving as the tiebreaker in those instances. Madam Chair and members, there's been, as Senator Cruz described, some certain measure of discussion. The legislative auditor had some recommendations. Those were specific to transit. And there's been some discussions in the legislative commission as well. But we really haven't dug in and pulled all the stakeholders together to really work through all of the possible different ideas and scenarios that we might have for constituting the Metropolitan Council and some governance models, really taking a good examination of what works and what doesn't work, what has worked in the past here, what hasn't worked, isn't working for us, what might be working really well in terms of regional governance and MPOs in other places. So to that end, Madam President, I'd like to offer the A2 amendment.
Senator Dibble offers the A2 amendment. The Secretary will report the amendment.
Senator Dibble moves to amend Senate File 2014 as follows. Delete everything after the enacting clause and insert. This is the A2 amendment.
To the amendment, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam President. Members, the A2 amendment is consistent with my Senate File 2278. And what it seeks to accomplish is to establish a task force on metropolitan governance. And it calls for membership, and I think what's most important about the membership on this task force is it really does put people at the table to have a very deliberate and intentional conversation with the goal of making a very specific set of recommendations to ourselves and to
Madam
the governor.
President.
Senator Cruz.
Point of order, Madam President.
State your point of order.
I'm questioning this amendment based on germaneness. What we have before us is a delete all amendment that I believe under Rule 35.2 relates to a substantially different subject in the matter that all we are doing here is strictly staggering terms that are already in existence. We're not in any way forming a task force. And then I would also say that this is a substantially different purpose.
Advice for the chair? Senator Dibble?
Well, Madam President, again, I strenuously disagree, as I did in the last questioning of germaneness. Was disappointed in that ruling, disappointed in all the rulings, frankly, that seem to construe minority amendments as not germane and majority amendments as always germane. This absolutely accomplishes the same task, and I will state once again the speech that Senator Cruz gave in support of his proposal is a speech he probably could have given in support of my proposal, and that we're seeking reform, we're seeking to be responsive to changes that are needed in the Metropolitan Council and how its governance structure is construed, and this simply takes a step away from his specific proposal and says, let's stop and take a look and put all the stakeholders together to come up with a more with a proposal that they put in front of the legislature and the governor.
Further advice. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. In looking at the bill and looking at the amendment, you may notice, Madam President, the amendment is a delete everything amendment, which is rarely, if ever, exercised in this chamber. Usually, if a bill gets to the floor, we certainly are welcoming amendments for discussion, but delete everythings are usually exactly that, and they usually have a substantially different purpose and oftentimes subject. So I would suspect that Senator Cruz's original concern would be well in order.
I am going to rule the A2 amendment out of order as not germane. It is intended to accomplish a substantially different purpose than the underlying bill.
Madam President?
Senator Dibble.
I would like to appeal the ruling of the chair under the appropriate rule, which I can't remember.
Senator
and
Dibble.
Request a roll call vote.
Roll call has been requested. Roll call granted. Senator Dibble has requested an appeal under 14.4. Senate Rule 14.4. An appeal is decided by a majority vote of those present and voting. Upon an appeal from the decision of the President, the question is, shall the decision of the President be the judgment of the Senate? A green vote, you agree with the President, and a red vote, you disagree with the President. Secretary will take the roll. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. Benson votes aye. Is it two? Benson votes aye. There being 39 ayes and 27 nays, the ruling of the chair has been sustained. Further discussion to Senate File 2014. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam President. I did just want to briefly address Senator Dibble's concern. I agree with Senator Dibble. I think we have a very, very long way to go. I'm looking forward to working on that going forward. I feel like this is a moving the needle in the right direction. I think you have increased accountability where instead of violent swings in opinion based on the entire council being brought forth by one governor, you'll have a little bit of balance there, which I think is very, very important in the fact that we have a government and a government entity here that has over $500 million in operating budget and over $500 million in capital investment budget every year. That's a significant amount of money, and I think any type of counterbalance that we can put on there, anything that we can do to kind of calm the waves, if you will, and not have big swings in which direction that body is going, the better off we'll be. So I'd appreciate a green vote.
Further discussion of Senate File 2014. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam President. I'd like to speak against the Senate File 2014 and disagree with Senator Cruz on his assumption that this bill would increase accountability. In fact, I think it will decrease the accountability to the public, in that once the members, take for instance, if 8 members of the Metropolitan Council were confirmed by the Senate, and then continue to serve after a new governor takes office, those 8 appointees would be accountable to no one and would not be able to be removed from the council even if there was strenuous disagreement over the positions that those Metropolitan Council members had with the current administration, the current governor. The 8 members that would be appointed by the current or the new governor, and that really creates a challenge for the chair of the Metropolitan Council, where the chair could have 8 members appointed by the current governor, 8 by the previous, and then the chair would be the tiebreaker. I think that would create confusion, and it would cause the chair of the Metropolitan Council to be negotiating constantly between those 2 different groups, and make it more likely that the chair would have to serve as a full-time member of the Metropolitan Council, because they would be forced to work out differences between the 2 different groups. So again, there are substantial differences between this bill and the Saltzman bill that some members of this body voted for several years back, and I would urge members to vote against the Cruz bill, and perhaps we should look more closely at the legislative auditor's recommendations and come back with a new solution in the future.
Further discussion, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam President. I am disappointed that we weren't able to vote on the Dibble amendment, because while I actually support Senator Cruz's intentions in terms of it being good governance to have the staggered terms, I think that we are just nibbling around the edges, and that there has been so much talk about potential restructuring ideas with regard to the Met Council. There has been, you know, talk of should they be elected, should they report to this entity. And it seems as though when there's been that much discussion and the Office of Legislative Auditor has made some strong suggestions, that we ought to take a time out, that we ought to in fact do some real work during the interim to decide what is the proper governance structure for this body. So I would have loved to be able to vote for the amendment. Given I can't do that, I will go ahead and support this small change, but reluctantly, because I don't think that it's really where we ought to be going at this time.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam President. Would Senator Cruz yield for a question?
Senator Cruz will yield. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Cruz, I was in the committee that heard this bill. We heard it in Local Government and Elections Committee, and we had a number of questions on some of the language, because we did feel that it was, as Senator Bonoff said, piecemeal. I mean, we really think that we should take a look at the metropolitan governance, and I also wish we could have voted on Senator Dibble's amendment to actually set up a task force on this. But we had a lot of questions about this bill, and my understanding is that you were going to work out some of the issues, and it goes to the language of misfeasance, malfeasance, or nonfeasance, which we needed some description of and some definition of. And I'm wondering if you could explain to me and to the body what work was done after committee, because it tended to be a theme in the committees that if the bill needed work, you would pass it out of committee and work on it, and then you would present a better bill for the next committee or the Senate floor. Of course, most of us in the committee would have rather had us do the work in committee, because we think that is where the work should be done. But could you explain to me what work was done on this after the committee in preparation for the Senate floor?
Senator Cruz. Madam President and Senator McGuire, essentially this is the legislation that we passed out of the local government committee. I know that there were two bills that came up that day, and I'm not quite sure if you're referring to this one or the other one. On this particular piece of legislation, the confusion had to do with the deletion of some language that made sure that each council member came from a representative district, and we as a committee had some questions as to why that would be deleted. I did go back after the fact and do a little bit of research on why that particular language that we actually reinstated in committee was deleted out of the original bill. I found out that that was because that language is duplicative. It's found other places in statute. So even though we do continue to have that language in the legislation that's before you, that and language considering the malfeasance and the ability to remove these members, both are included in other places in statute.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Cruz, would Senator Cruz yield for another question?
Senator Cruz will yield. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator Cruz, could you explain to us then what misfeasance, malfeasance, or nonfeasance is and where it is defined in statute? It might be in other bills, but I'm wondering if it's actually defined. And what I'm hearing from you is that there was no other work done with any of the people that had concerns about this bill after it left committee, that you maybe did some research, but that you didn't really work with any of the parties that were in the committee that had expressed concerns over it, and so you brought basically the same bill forward to the Senate that we saw in committee that some of us had concerns over.
Senator Cruz.
Madam President and Senator McGuire, these are actually defined in statute under 35.14, and they are very legal terms that have implications applied to them.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam President. I don't want to belabor this point, but Senator Cruz, is there a definition of them? If I might ask him to yield.
Senator Cruz.
Madam President, Senator McGuire, there is. If you'd like, I can read those definitions right now, or I could get you a copy of the statute, whichever you would prefer.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam President. Yes, Senator Cruz, why don't you read them for me, please?
Madam President.
Senator Cruz.
Senator McGuire, under 35.14, it has the definitions. Subdivision 2, it defines malfeasance. Malfeasance means the willful commission of an unlawful or wrongful act in the performance of a public official's duty, which is outside the scope, the authority of the public official, and which infringes on the rights of any person or entity. Subdivision 3, nonfeasance. Nonfeasance means the willful failure to perform a specific act, which is a required part of the duties of the public official. Subdivision 4, misfeasance. Misfeasance means...
Madam President, point of order.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam President. I think the statute books are available to all members, and I think there are rules against us just reading statutes on the Senate floor.
There is a Mason's rule about reading on the floor, although if Senator McGuire can't pull those up on her computer, she may wish those to be read to her. Senator McGuire, do you wish Senator Cruz to continue reading the statutes? Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam President. I appreciate those definitions that Senator Cruz has given us. I think the public can't always pull those up, so I just wanted them to be aware of what those words meant. And I think that there's just a lot of work that this bill needs, because while they're defined in statute, there's still implications that there are consequences that we weren't clear about in committee, and that this bill continued to need work. These are very broad definitions, and the bill just needed more work in committee. And I wanted to make the point that it still came to the Senate floor without the work being done when we asked that work be done in committee. So I'm just making that point that it would be good to have bills come to the Senate floor that have had the work done in committee. So I ask members to vote against this bill because it does need more work.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Would Senator McGuire yield for a question?
Senator McGuire will yield. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator McGuire, I know this is a very important bill, and I know you're intimately concerned about it, but I'm kind of curious. Could you share with us what work is not done on the bill?
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Well, we had concerns about what the implications of those words would be, and the problem with dealing with this on the Senate floor is that we don't have the people here that were concerned with it. We had people come and speak to us about the issues that they had with the wording here and what it really meant and what the consequences of this wording are. So the problem with doing bills like this that aren't ready on the floor is that you don't have the people that are working on these issues here to testify. It's just us saying what we think, and a lot of times there's people that are out in the field that are working on these issues that they have a better sense of what these words mean and what the implications are, and we had people testify that they were confused about what this meant. And so that's what I'm reflecting here, is that we bring up a lot of these questions in committees, and the bills continue to be passed out without those issues being addressed.
Senator McGuire, what words need definition? Could you tell me what words they are? I'm sure there's a lot of, you certainly have a lot of passion for this issue, and I would imagine that the words you have are right on the tip of your tongue. Could you tell us? Because maybe we could help with the definition of the words that you're claiming are undone work that needs to be done, or I haven't gotten to the implications that you mentioned, too, so maybe you can prepare about that as well. That'll be my next three questions.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam President. Well, Senator Limmer is demonstrating why this is why we shouldn't be doing this on the Senate floor, because there's a lot of debate that we could have about these words, and I don't think we should have it on the Senate floor. I think we should have had it in committee. I think we should have addressed the issues before it got passed out, and I do not feel that we should be debating these issues on the Senate floor. So I think we should have this bill go back to committee and work on it there. This is not the place that you should be working on language of bills. It should be done in committee.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator McGuire, you tell us that there's work that hasn't been done on the bill, and you cannot tell us. You say there's words that need definitions, and you cannot tell us. You say that there's implications on the bill, but you can't frame them. And yet you ask a freshman senator to read to you what malfeasance is in statute. Senator McGuire, I don't think you want to debate this bill at all. I'm not quite sure what the motive is, and I'm not going to ask or even impugn the motive, because that isn't,
Madam President,
that isn't appropriate for me to say.
Senator Ladstage, point of order.
Madam President, I believe the rules of the Senate require that all comments be addressed through the President, not directly to members of the Senate.
Thank you, Senator Latz. Senator Limmer. Take that as a reminder.
Thank you, Madam President. And could you pass on my thanks to Senator Latz for correcting my behavior on the Senate floor?
I think he heard that.
Madam President, it will always be my pleasure to do so.
Madam President,
Senator Limmer.
I think the point has been made.
Senator Ortman?
Well, Madam President, I know it's kind of a shocking concept, but good bill, vote yes, bad bill, vote no. That's kind of my rule of thumb, and if you don't like it, vote no. But I think the work has been done, and we know what we're voting on. I hope we'll just vote.
Secretary will give Senate File 2014 its third reading.
Senate File Number 2014, a bill for an act relating to metropolitan government, third reading.
Secretary will take the roll on Senate File 2014. All those senators having voted who desire to vote, the secretary will close the roll. There being 42 ayes and 24 nays, the bill is passed and its title agreed to. Remaining under motions and resolutions, we will go to the third order of business, messages from the House. The secretary will read the message.
Madam President, I have the honor to announce that the House refuses to concur in the Senate amendments to House File Number 2083. House File 2083, a bill for an act relating to education. The House respectfully requests that the Conference Committee of five members be appointed thereon. Garofalo, Kelly, Loon, Woodard, and Greiling have been appointed as such committee on the part of the House. House File Number 2083 is herewith transmitted to the Senate with the request that the Senate appoint a like committee. Alban A. Mathewitz, Chief Clerk, House of Representatives.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam President. I move that the Senate accede to the request of the House for a Conference Committee on House File Number 2083. And that a conference committee of five members be appointed by the subcommittee on conference committees on the part of the Senate to act with a like conference committee appointed on the part of the House.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Moving to the fifth order of business, reports of committees. There is a report to be read. Secretary will read.
Senator Ortman from the Committee on Taxes, to which was referred Senate File Number 2321, a bill for an act relating to transportation, providing for alternatives for contracting and procurement, reports the same back with the recommendation that the bill be amended as follows. And when so amended, the bill do pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Amendments adopted and report adopted.
Senator Senjum.
Madam President, I would move that the committee report read by the Secretary be adopted.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Moving to the eighth order of business, introduction and first reading of Senate bills. The Secretary will read the introduction.
Senate file number 2571, a bill for an act relating to transportation capital improvements, authorizing spending to acquire and better public land and buildings. First reading.
It will be referred to the Committee on Transportation. First reading. Senator Senjan, would you like a brief recess?
Madam President, I would like to move to a brief recess for purposes of appointing a conference committee.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are in recess. Senjan.
Madam President, is there a report at the desk?
I think there is, Senator Senjan. Yes, the Secretary will report.
Senator Senjan from the Subcommittee on Conference Committees recommends that the following senators be, and they hereby are, appointed as a conference committee on House File Number 2083, Olson, Daley, Cruz, Peterson, and Lilly. Senator Senjan moves that the foregoing appointments be approved.
On that motion, all in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Announcements of Senate interest. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam President. And I have a point of personal privilege. I've had trouble several times the last few weeks getting into my committees because they're all scheduled at the same time. And I'm wondering what the rush is, why we can't spread these out, because I'm not the only one that's happening to, both Republicans and Democrats. And when we're not in committee, we're not a voice for our constituents. And we don't get to hear the details of the bills. So I would like to ask Senator Senjan to yield for a question.
Senator Senjan will yield. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam President. And Senator Senjan, I'm trying to find out if the reason that we're moving through these bills so quickly is that we're going to have an adjournment date perhaps that we haven't been told about yet. So I would ask you, when are you planning adjournment?
Senator Senjan.
Madam President, members, there is no planned date for adjournment at this point. I will say that we're on a glide path. We're not sure exactly when the wheels will touch the ground, but anticipate that we're working under a more accelerated basis right now, and we're trying to get our work done.
Madam President.
Senator Goodwin.
Well, Senator Senjan, yield for another question, please.
Senator Senjan will yield. Senator Goodwin.
Senator Senjan, I wanted to find out if you are planning an April 5th adjournment date, as we've heard the House is planning.
Senator Senjan.
Madam President, there is no specific commitment to an April 5th adjournment date. I think some in the body would appreciate it if there was, but at this point there is no specific commitment to that date. We've got to let this play out in the fashion that it needs to, and to pre-commit to a date I think would be irresponsible.
Senator Howe.
I rise for a point of personal privilege.
Senator Howe.
We have a legislative directory that's been going around the body here, and we've been adding comments on it for Senator Kubley's family, and I would just ask for members to check their desk and look for that, because I want to finish getting it around here and then get it over to the House of Representatives for their signatures. So if members could please check and find that legislative directory that has those comments in it. Thank you.
Without objection, the following senators will be excused for today. Senator Koch from 11 to 115, Senator Roebling from 1 to 145, Senator Thompson from 140 to 155, Senator Benson from 2 to 215. Without objection, they are excused.
Madam President.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam President. Point of personal privilege.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam President. I rise to once again publicly request information about when the Subcommittee on Ethical Conduct will reconvene. Yesterday, we were told that the subcommittee did not reconvene at the agreed-upon time last Friday night on the advice of counsel, and we'll see where this goes going forward. I guess I'm wondering, where is this going, and will the Ethics Subcommittee reconvene at all? The agreed upon time by a 3-1 vote by the committee to reconvene came and went, and the committee should have met to at least adjourn to a time certain. The members of the subcommittee, Senator Michelle and myself, deserve to know what the plan is to resolve this complaint, and resolving this in a transparent way is in the best interest of the Senate. And since the Madam President has gone back to her seat, then would Senator Fischbach yield and respond to my question? Thank you.
Senator Fischbach will yield. Senator Fischbach.
Mr. President, I think that we are all aware of those who were in attendance or have heard about the Ethics Committee meeting that we did hold Friday. The complaint before the subcommittee obviously involves matters that may be at issue in claims that are made against the Senate, and we were being advised by counsel there were certain places we should not or could not go during that committee hearing. Obviously, the situation is unprecedented in front of the Senate, and it certainly needs to be carefully handled. And so at this point, I have temporarily postponed further subcommittee proceedings to allow time for the Senate's outside counsel in pending litigation to advise the Senate regarding the matters that are before us.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. President, I think if Madam President would take some advice, the proper procedure would have been to reconvene the subcommittee and then upon agreement of the members to adjourn until a time certain. I think to leave us all hanging there and the committee kind of hanging was perhaps not the best way to proceed.
Senator Gimsey.
Mr. President and members of the Senate Transportation Committee, expect that in the next day or so, hopefully tomorrow, we'll have a short committee hearing to hear Senate File 2571. Just want to give you a heads up on that and make you aware that that will be happening.
Further announcements, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. President. Myself and all the members that live on the I-90 corridor would like to, Senator Sparks and everybody else, would like to invite you to the I-90 party. And rumor has it, it probably trumps the Ranger party. That's what I've heard. It's a very good party. So we have pork chops on a stick. We have all the food from southern Minnesota and some lively libations. It's tomorrow night at the Kellogg at 5:30. So I would hope you all can come.
Mr. President.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. President, Senator Rosen, I will be there. And the key word you used was rumor.
Further announcements of Senate interest. Senator Sinjum.
Thank you, Mr. President. And I just wanted to maybe once more remind the body, I think I did this yesterday, that I did in fact speak with the Ethics Committee members on the DFL side Friday night. I told them the circumstances that existed. I indicated to them that there were going to be no further proceedings that evening. I may or may not have that authority, but they were certainly advised of that. And along the way, in fact, Senator Bach and I had talked to that extent, and he was in fact then going to also talk to his members. So I think we were generally fair. I think we have a situation before us that needs to be handled gently and appropriately, and I think we're on the path of doing that. In addition to that, Mr. President, if I could, if the DFL members of the Capital Investment Committee could meet in room 208 immediately after session, and that's right across the hall here, that would be wonderful. And in addition to that, if the Senate Republican Committee chairs could meet in room 318 at 315, that would be wonderful. So they are the announcements that I have, other than to say, unless there's no more, that the business of the day now be completed. I would move me adjourn until March 28th at 11 o'clock. And Mr. Chair, maybe I also should add, you should be anticipating that we're going to move, be meeting on Friday. We've got bills to do and work to be done, and so from the standpoint of your personal calendar, anticipate a Friday session.
On the motion to adjourn, all in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, same sign. Senate is in adjournment.